This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
And welcome back to our Lifetime Income series, an ongoing saga here on the Financial Sense News Hour. And if you remember in our previous episodes, we have discussed rather extensively retirement. We've actually used real world, real case examples, of course, changing the names of the people involved. Today, we're going to discuss the issue of when to retire, or what happens if someday somebody says, roses are red, carnations are white, you've been retired as of tonight, you know?
Haven't heard that one.
Which is
new one for me, John.
Which is what's happening to a lot of people due to the downturn in the economy, especially since 2007. But it's also been a phenomenon of the downsizing and the relocation of companies either to other parts of the United States or to other countries elsewhere in the world. Now, if you recall in previous programs, we discussed the necessity of putting together a plan, how to use the plan, how to stick to the plan, how to build contingencies into the plan. Now we've come to the point, all right, you've got to make the big moment. Are you going to flip the switch and retire? Or what happens if somebody flips the switch for you?
Yeah, probably since we began this series, we've talked about the importance of having a plan. At least you have something you can work with. It helps you deal with making the right kind of decisions. And then also planning for contingencies. And we all know that there are contingencies, whether it's health issues, portfolio issues, family issues. But what we're going to focus on today is when you retire, what precedes that plan. In other words, making the decision as to when to retire is equally as important because a lot of key decisions need to be made, John, before you retire.
Yeah, one of the things that we went over last week on the program were the surveys of people who are either just about to retire, retired, or maybe not too far away from that. We found that the optimism about the ability to retire tends to decline as the groups get older. The confidence in the ability to retire diminishes with older individuals due largely to those things we were talking about being somewhat out of people's control, inflation and medical expenses. Now, those were surveys that were taken nationally. I know you're in this business of helping people plan for retirement, Jim. How do you find, just comparing your clientele to what's going on the national level?
I would say, John, we're fortunate that most of our clients are on the affluent side, so most of them are in pretty good shape. But I would say one trend that we're seeing and have seen in our practice over the last couple of decades that stands out is the trend away from early retirement, both among men and women. I mean, it used to be, you know, when you think back to our parents, you worked for a company 25, 30 years, you retired at age 62 or age 65, but the goal was early retirement. Oh boy, 62, I can't wait. I'm going to play golf. I'm going to travel. I'm going to do all those things I never had time to do. What is interesting is there was a study done that a couple of years ago by the U.S. Census Bureau, and this will just go to show you this trend that has changed, and this goes back to 1990, and this is the percentage of individuals age 65 years and older that are still working. Now, in 1990, the percentage of 65-year-old men working was 16.3%. By the year 2000, it went to 17.7%. By 2005, it was 19.8%. It took a big jump in 2010. I think a lot of that had to do with the recession. It is now 22.1%, and it's projected by the Census Bureau to rise to 27% by 2018. Likewise with women, age 65 and older, 8.6% working in 1990. The figure goes up slightly to 9.4 in the year 2000, 11.5% in 2005, 13.8% in 2010, and then projected to be about 19% in 2018. So if there's anything that we've seen is there is a tendency now to work longer. And I think that trend is escalating, as in the census projections, that it'll rise and grow even larger by the time we get to the end of this decade or close to it.
Are there some factors that we could use to explain why this trend is what it is?
Yeah, I would say probably at the top of the list, John, has been changes in government legislation. There have been three major pieces of legislation that have come about over the probably the last couple of decades. First of all, is mandatory retirement was increased by legislation from age 65 to age 70, and that goes back to 1978. And in 1986, it was outlawed almost entirely. So in other words, depending on your profession, I mean, obviously, if you're a pilot or require a lot of physical stress or manual, that could be different. But I would say they did away with that in 1986. So one was doing away with mandatory retirement ages. Secondly, it was a piece of legislation introduced in 1983, which was a penalty on earnings of Social Security recipients, making work financially more attractive. In other words, if you did, let's say, retire and get your Social Security benefits and you did work, you were penalized. In other words, you lost a good majority of your Social Security benefits. And then in the year 2000, we had the Senior Citizens Freedom to Work Act, which repealed Social Security retirement earnings limit on the amount that a person could earn once they reach their full retirement age. And right now, depending on where you're born, if you're born after 1943, that full retirement age is now 66. And if you were born later, the full retirement age is 67. And then I think another factor that we've seen is, and this began in the 80s, we talked about this on the program last week, is the movement in the private sector away from defined benefit pension plans, which are still operational at the federal government level and at the state and municipal level, but that is going to be restructured. And one of the things that we're seeing, we saw this in the recent elections here in San Diego and San Jose, where they're moving for younger workers now. They're taking them out of defined benefit plans and they're putting them in defined contribution plans. And then I would say probably the last reason is low savings and bad financial markets, especially probably the last 12 years with two bear markets in stock and a downturn in real estate.
Well, we always talk about the unknowns of the future. You give where the economy is right now, but we've been talking about a fiscal cliff, increased tax rate, inflation continuing. How do you see these trends, say we projected out 10 years, 15 years? Are these trends going to continue? And if so, what's driving it?
Oh, absolutely. I think the percentages, the Census Bureau will probably increase even more because it's not taking into account the high unemployment rate, which is one of the case study that we're going to talk about this week will be a good example of. But I think the high unemployment rate and the severity of this recession argues for this trend continuing if people, you know, they're going to be forced to do it. And I think there's a number of factors that argue for this. Number one, the change that we talked about from defined benefit plans to defined contribution plans, which by themselves favor longer careers. In other words, the longer you work, the more you accumulate. I think the deductions on Social Security, that if you work and get Social Security early, you really get penalized if you take early Social Security prior to age 66 or 67. I think that the low savings rate, and also due to two recessions in the last decade, a lot of people that lost their jobs have become self-employed. I think that's another trend. Now, the good news on this is the longer people stay in the workforce, that means they continue to, number one, work, which brings tax revenues to the Treasury, and keeps the Social Security and the Medicare fund more solvent. In fact, if you look at Simpson-Bowles, if you look at the Paul Ryan plan, all the new plans being proposed are talking about extending the retirement age to 69, and I think that's going to happen. So another 2 years to reflect the fact that people are living longer. And then also, I think just the fact that we're looking at a zero interest rate environment, there was a study put out by Financial Finesse, the state of U.S. employees' financial preparedness, and they said there is a growing gap. Now, this was done in a study that was published last year, a growing gap between what Americans dream of doing in retirement and what they may be capable of achieving. What I found was interesting, Most employees between age 55 and 64, almost 60%, had not run any calculations to determine if they were saving enough to allow them to retire. And we've all seen the statistics, especially in the 90s and in this last decade, where the savings rate in the country got down to zero. So Americans were saving less. And I think if you take a look at not only the postponement of retirement, a lot of the legislation that we've seen passed over the last couple decades where it removed the penalty of working longer, I think that as either retirement benefits are delayed, the nature of pension plans that are changed that favor longer working environment, I think we're going to go back to, John, to a period of time where individuals are going to have to be dependent on themselves and becoming self-sufficient rather than depending on employers and government.
Okay, so far we've been talking about the factors affecting retirement and what trends are going to continue through the next 10 years. Let's see if we can bring this down now to action items. And obviously you're going to have a series of decisions that have to be made that trigger various events in your life. What are the decisions? How do you know when to make them and not feel like you're jumping off a cliff when you do?
Well, I'd probably say when you're thinking about retirement, there's probably four key decisions. And at the top of the list, number one, it's probably the most important. Can I afford it? In other words, can I afford to retire now, given your age, given your lifestyle, given your expenses, given the sources of income that you're going to have, whether it's Social Security, company pensions, or let's say investment assets, or personal savings. So at the top of the list, can I afford it? Number two, is this the right time? And that is really a personal decision. I've had clients that have retired just simply because of job stress. I had a case recently where the job stress, a gentleman worked for a company a long time. They got bought out by another company. The new personnel coming in was creating so much stress. He felt that basically they were trying to sort of, in many ways, force him out. So, you know, the question is it the right time? And then third, how will that retirement affect, let's say, a spouse or family members? What happens if the husband retires and the spouse is expected to survive him? What happens with the cutoff of retirement benefit, or let's say group benefits such as health insurance and life insurance, medical coverage? Major, major decision. And then I think the last one, John, is do you want to retire? I have clients. We discussed the case of Matt and Deborah Stein, a cardiologist who loved what he did. And so he's working part-time. He really didn't want to retire. So those are probably the key four questions to ask. And then also, I think we're seeing a lot more of it today, is when all of a sudden you are forced to confront retirement rather quickly. In the case of, let's say a corporation is going through downsizing, so they create some kind of early retirement incentive program, or companies that are having financial trouble offer early retirement packages. And as retirees learn very quickly, it's usually better to take the first wave that's being offered, because if the financial conditions of the company deteriorate, the next wave of benefit package probably won't be as great. So, you know, there's a number of reasons to consider this. Either one, it's suddenly forced on you. In this case, you have no choice, because usually when they offer a downsizing package or early retirement, you've got to make a decision within a 3 or 4 week period. But if you're not in that situation, I'd say the four key things: can I afford it? Is it the right time? How would my retirement affect a spouse or other family members? And then probably a personal decision: do you really want to retire?
Yeah, my wife says I'll probably never retire. When I die, they'll have to pry the microphone from my cold, dead hands after 40 years of doing radio and TV. Can we break each one of these decisions down and look at the factors that affect it? Start with the first one.
Okay, probably at the top of the list, can I afford it? The question you really have to ask and you're faced with when making that retirement decision is, can I afford it? Because the bills come every month. They don't stop just because you're retired, and those bills will keep coming whether, you know, you're retired or not. You have things like physical assets such as an automobile you may have to replace, something breaks down on the house, a roof repair, replacing the battery on the car, and let's not talk about repair to one's own body. Knees have to be replaced, physical type of needs, whether it's going to a dentist, glasses. So I think the real key thing is determining, as we have talked about here with that budget, determining the retirement income needs. And then when you know what you're going to be spending from the essential to the bucket list to down the road, you know, then taking a look at, okay, where are my sources of income going to come from? Social Security, maybe company pension plans, personal savings, things that you have, investment portfolio. And then you have to look at maybe some possible options. In other words, it may make sense to postpone retirement because your Social Security benefits grow. It gives you more time to accumulate assets. You may want to consider factoring in part-time work or maybe even just, you know, reducing lifestyle expectations. When you analyze it all, you go, well, maybe what we thought we were going to be able to do, the second home, the vacation home, traveling around the world, maybe some of that is going to have to be adjusted. And then when it gets down to, I'd say, the second decision, is the right time to retire? Boy, I tell you, that's really a highly personal decision. A lot of it evolves around personal health issues. In early retirement, it could be actually forced upon you, as we're going to discuss in this week's case study, where so many companies are downsizing, relocating. So there are a number of issues there. And, you know, you also have to think about the third issue. How does this affect a spouse? Because when you do retire, a lot more companies today are not, in addition to pensions, they're not giving their retirees medical plans. So all of a sudden you're faced with, and especially when you start getting into 60s before you're eligible at age 65 for Medicare, the medical insurance is very, very expensive when you get into your 60s. I mean, we spend anywhere from $2,000 to $2,200 a month for older employees I know at our firm, and I'm sure it's probably a little cheaper for larger corporations, but that's a major issue. Life insurance benefits can be cut off, but I would say medical is a major issue that has to be addressed. And then I think the other thing that comes into play, which is probably the last one that you have to think about, is do you want to retire? You may find, for example, that the work that you do or the profession you're employed in, or you own your own business, you find your work very satisfying. And then also, what kind of degree of control you may have over your work or the pace or schedule. I think another factor is, do you feel appreciated? I had one client that retired, I mentioned earlier, due to stress. He worked for this company for several decades, and then they were taken over by another company. It was just creating too much stress in his life. And he felt his years of service with the company, with the new company that took over, weren't really appreciated. So he made the decision. And then, John, you know, it reminded me of a comment that one of my older clients, who's in his 70s, still working, and he said, you know, this really stands out. He said, you know, my retired friends, many are his own age. He must be about 74, 75 now, spend most of their time with other old people. All they seem to talk about is who died, which funeral they attended, who's in the hospital, how much their medicines are costing them. Frankly, he said, I'd rather be working. So, you know, those are, I would say, if you want to boil them down, those are probably the four key decisions. Can you afford it? Is it the right time? How is my retirement going to affect my spouse or other family members? And quite honestly, do you want to retire?
Well, then there's the issue of unexpected retirement, such as when plant closings occur in your state and they move to another state. And a lot of times they don't want to take a lot of the current staff with them. And suddenly you're retired. Let's face it, in certain areas, Jim, there's probably age discrimination that goes on here, but it's going to be one of those hard things to deal with. And you know what? If you're the person laid off, you still have to face it anyway.
Yeah, this week's case is as much a story about an unexpected retirement as it is on the U.S. process of deindustrialization and outsourcing that's taken place of our manufacturing base over the last three decades. And then I would probably throw in bad politics. We're going to call them Jones. Obviously, I don't want to use the last name, but this is Gary and Kathy Jones. And Gary is age 64. His wife, Kathy, is age 62. Now, Gary is a war vet, spent 12 years in the military, got out of the military, got his MBA, started out his career in manufacturing, with a defense contractor here in San Diego, moved here in San Diego in 1980 to work for a company that used to be one of actually San Diego's largest employers, General Dynamics. He ran the production line. That was his specialty, and he ran that until 1991. In 1991, the U.S. was in a recession. California governor raised the income tax rate to 11.3%, raised it 2 percentage points, raised workers' comp. General Dynamics said, that's it, we're out of here. They pulled out, moved basically the plant to Tucson, Arizona. So he got laid off. Early on in the decade, he then went to work for NCR, which was bought out by AT&T. Got laid off in 1995. Then he went to work for Sony, which the division that he was working for were making these monitors for a lot of the computer manufacturers like Dell Computer, HP. They pulled out of California for the same reason that many states are moving out. They moved their plant to Mexico, got downsized early on in the last decade. And by accident, he started helping a real estate agent friend of theirs. And remember, this goes back to the beginning of the last decade when the real estate market really started getting moving and moved into a bubble territory. Eventually, he went to work for a large bank here in California as a home equity loan officer. And here's the sad part. After 10 years, they just closed down their Southern Regional Loan Office and are in the process of transferring it to Phoenix. So he just got laid off about 6 weeks ago. So here, once again, if you take a look at his career, manufacturing was his specialty, especially running production lines. Got downsized with General Dynamics when they moved to California, downsized with NCR when AT&T bought him, downsized by Sony when they shipped their plants to Mexico, and now downsized once again as the loan offices of Southern California are being moved to Phoenix, where they can control their cost, and it's a lot cheaper to run.
Yeah, this brings up what I just mentioned a little while ago. Did he ask for a transfer? Because a lot of times, there was a company in your city, as a matter of fact, Buck Knives, that moved its whole plant up here to Idaho. And a lot of times you can go with them if you want to move, if you don't want to stay in the area where you're at. Other times there are other considerations, especially if there's a merger involved in the move.
He asked to be transferred because they have a son that lives in Phoenix, Arizona. So this would have been a great transfer, but they denied it. They denied him the transfer. They only took a few key employees. And I think this is just my own personal opinion here, but the fact that he's age 64, I imagine some bean counter at the company took a look at how much they were paying him medical benefits and decided that, because who knows if you want to bring a discrimination suit, but it was the employees that did get transferred, he found out, were mainly the younger employees. So to me, that kind of tells me it was more of an age issue than anything else.
All right, well, let's assume that they're in that circumstance then. What are they going to do?
Well, I would say if there's one saving grace here for both Gary and Kathy is when they moved here in 1980, they bought a home here in California, which is now paid off. That's the one saving grace that they have. And even though it's not worth probably what it was, I mean, at the peak of the market, it was probably close to 900, a little over 900,000. It's down now to about 750. They put their home on the market and they figure, you know, they might be able to net 700,000 out of it. And they are considering moving to Sun City, Arizona, where they've actually been looking at property and a smaller home, obviously, because it's just the two of them now, and they'd be closer to their son. But they can pick a home. They've been looking at anywhere from 200 to maybe 250. So the plan is to put the house for sale. And the good news is the real estate market in Southern California has picked up. Homes are firming up in price. Obviously, mortgage rates are low, so the real estate market is very active here. So they're not going to have, their agent said, no problem in selling their house. But they figure they might net $700,000. One never knows, and maybe even more. His wife, Kathy, is the manager of a high-end women's clothing store. She's a manager there, and she's put in, she could transfer to one of their Phoenix stores. The only difference is right now she's a manager, so she's making a little bit more money. If she transfers to Phoenix, she'd have to go back to an hourly rate, which she found out would be about $14 an hour. But at least she would get medical benefits. And right now, you know, Gary's receiving unemployment benefits here in California. The maximum is about $450 a week. And because he's a veteran, at least, thank goodness, his medical is free at the VA. Actually, John, here's the one redeeming thing. It's actually cheaper than when he was working for the bank, because as a veteran, a lot of this stuff is free. And unfortunately, he has type 2 diabetes, blood pressure, and he has to take a lot of medications. Kathy would get her medical transferring to the chain in Phoenix. So that's a good news. So there's some redeeming things here.
You know, in the past, we've been talking about the whole issue of unanticipated items in retirement, like inflation and taxes and then medical care. But here's one that a lot of people don't anticipate. You had a plan and suddenly, boop, 6 to 7 years premature, whatever it happens to be, suddenly you're out. So how do you adjust the plan to deal with that? You try to find work elsewhere, a partial job, even if it doesn't bring in as much income as it did before, but try to stay on track. What are the options?
Well, the plan that we're putting together is going to involve the things that are available to them right now. For example, unemployment benefits, transfer to a cheaper location, and obviously monetizing a major asset of theirs, which is their home. That's the one redeeming savings here. But the thing that struck me about this, the plan was, I mean, a home equity loan officer, you know, that's something that he could have worked well into his late 60s, because obviously it's not manual labor. But, you know, he's age 64, and this is the condition that's been thrust upon him. So the plan is to wait or postpone receiving Social Security benefits, because his full retirement age would be age 66. He's 64, so we got roughly a little less than 2 years to wait to get the full retirement benefits. And it's estimated his retirement benefit at age 66 would be a little over $1,800 a month. The plan for Kathy would be to work until age 65, and maybe even longer, because she likes what she does, because at age 65, then she would also qualify for Medicare, because medical is a major expense here. The plan is, if the home sells, when the home sells here, they've been shopping in Arizona, probably not in the last month. It's been almost 115 degrees there. Talk about a change in weather patterns. But their plan would be to pay cash for a home. And that, depending on whether they spend $200 or $250, whatever that is, that would free up some cash, roughly about $450,000. And we're talking about doing an immediate annuity on both their lives in a 10-year certain, meaning if something happened to both of them before 10 years, the balance of the payments would go to their son. And that would produce about $2,150. So if we take a look at their income stream right now, unemployment benefits are about $450. We're looking into how that might change if they move to Arizona. But that's about $1,800 a month, almost what he would get at age 66 if he got full Social Security benefits. Kathy, if she transfers and goes to an hourly wage in Arizona, that would be about $14 an hour, but that would produce about $2,250 a month, and then the annuity would produce about $2,150. Now, they'd pay cash for a house, so that would produce about $6,200 a month in income. And they figured their expenses, John, wish for and essential, range between $4,000 and $4,500 a month, depending on what they want to do on vacations. I'm sure the vacations would be here in California, where they have a lot of friends, especially during the summer months in Arizona. They have about $230,000 in their IRAs as a result of 401ks. So their plan is not to touch the $230,000, we're going to put that in our dividend income program, and they're not going to touch that until they retire or age 70 and a half. In other words, they'd like to make that accumulate. So right now, that's the existing plan, which depends on three factors. One, selling the house, paying cash for a new house, using the difference between downsizing to a smaller home to buy an annuity, in effect create a pension, a defined benefit pension plan for both Gary and Kathy. Kathy continuing to work and unemployment benefits of roughly about $450 a month for as long as possible. Currently, they're about 99 weeks. Who knows, that may change next year, but that is the current plan. And then to keep the IRAs invested in dividend income and not touch that until they have to or are required to take distributions at age 70 and a half.
Well, now what happens if we factor in Social Security here? You know, Gary gets to be age 66. Theoretically, he can become relatively fully vested in Social Security. Kathy's 65. What changes then? Because her $2,000 a month income is going to drop off.
Well, at age 66, Gary's income would almost equal what he's getting in unemployment, probably a little bit larger, almost $1,900. So that'd be about, well, let's just round it off and say it's $1,800. If Kathy decides to retire at age 65, the formula for a reduction of benefits before full retirement age is 5/9 of 1% for each month below the full retirement age. So if she retired at age 65, she would be retiring 1 year early. That would reduce her retirement benefits by roughly a little over 6%. So she'd get about 94% of her Social Security, which would be a little bit over $900 a month. So between the two of them, their Social Security at that time would be about $2,800 a month. The annuity would continue at $2,150. So you're talking about $4,900 a month. And remember, their living standard is between $4,000 and $4,500 a month. Of course, we have to factor in inflation. But the dividend income program is producing about 4% income, let's say 3 to 4% growth in that area. If they wanted to withdraw that, we're projecting it would probably be worth about $315. At age 65, that would produce roughly about $1,100 a month. So a little over $12,000 a year. So they'd be close to $5,900 a month. Now, what they plan on doing, assuming this all works, they sell the house, they can get a good price, and there's a good chance because the real estate market is actually looking good here in Southern California right now. Their budget is about $4,000 a month, depending on what they do on the bucket list. They can save, they figure, between $1,200 and $1,500 a month. Now, if Kathy were to work to age 66, she would get full retirement benefits, which would be in the upper, you know, probably another 6%. So let's say around $960, $970 a month. And also that would be one more year of accumulation of savings. They could have a nice little nest egg built up in their dividend income program. So they continue, they hope they'll be able to continue to save. And, you know, she also stands the chance that even though she's going to an hourly wage when she transfers, when they move to Arizona, she always has the chance to move up to a manager level again where she could even make more money. So, you know, but we're not counting on that. So the plan is at least for Kathy to work to age 65, for Gary to wait to age 66 to get full retirement benefits from Social Security. He's got his medical covered with the VA. Kathy has a medical plan with the clothing company and to continue savings and then to take the excess out of the house and create an immediate annuity that would produce a monthly income of close to $2,200 a month for both of them that will last their entire lifetime. So in a nutshell, John, this is a plan that's still in process. They haven't sold their house yet. They have some prospective buyers. They're hoping that within the next couple of weeks that one of these prospective buyers will actually make an offer because summer is the best time to buy a house because families moving want to move into a school district and get settled. And then the idea or the plan would be is to move on to Arizona, pay cash for a house. But right now, Kathy's still a manager making pretty good money at the clothing store. So that's coming in. Medical's covered. But this is a plan in process.
And we will cover more of issues such as this in upcoming Lifetime Income series right here on Financial Sense. You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
Wouldn't it be nice if we were older, then we wouldn't have to wait so long? And wouldn't it be nice to live together in the kind of world where we belong? No one's gonna make it that much better. We can say goodnight and stay together.
Well, starting at this part of the program, we begin taking your calls on the queue line. So if you're new to the show, the queue lines, meaning question or comment, are open 24 hours a day to record your questions for the program or your comments. Please keep them at or below a minute. There is a toll-free number that works in the U.S. and Canada, toll-free, 800-794-6480, 800-794-6480. That does work from the rest of the world, but it's only toll-free from the U.S. and Canada. And as we respond to your questions here, please remember that the financial Sense NewsHour is provided to you for information and educational purposes only, and you should never consider what you hear on the program as an offer to purchase or sell securities. And when we respond to your calls, these are generic answers to the information you give us based on the personal opinions of Jim Poplava. And because we don't know a lot about you, we can't take into account your suitability, your objectives, or your risk tolerance. Because of that, we're not liable to anyone for financial losses resulting from investing in companies profiled on the program.
Yeah, hi, Jim and John. This is Richard calling from California. Except for the economic theory concerning private sector growth, is there any legitimate theory floating around out there that explains how we could still avoid the economic consequences of very slow or no growth? You, John, and all the other economists I have paid attention to state that growth is essential in order to avoid or at least lessen the effects of the predicted storm of crises. Yet the forces allied against the private sector growth, such as the necessary political, financial, and fiscal reform, seem just as immune to change as all the subordinate crises, with a list growing daily, like political correctness, the purpose of government, housing, cronyism, accountability, education, etc. The full list is really overwhelming. Perhaps these unhealthy values have become a matter of culture and therefore cannot be changed without something outside our control forcing changes in mentality. In that case, no growth is something permanent, and we will have to live with it for a long time. Hence my question. Except for the economic theory concerning private sector growth, is there any legitimate theory floating around out there that explains how we could still avoid the economic consequences? Thanks for your program.
Richard, unfortunately, it's too late. I think this is going to have to play itself out, and probably the best understanding of how it plays out, what comes out afterwards, how to avoid it, and explain why it occurs was best explained by the Austrian economist. And so if you can pick up a copy of Ludwig von Mises, Hayek, or Murray Rothbard, boy, there's so many good Austrian books out there that Man, Economy, and State, The Credit Cycle by Ludwig von Mises. Jesus Huerta de Soto is another great one. Henry Hazlitt. Just Google Austrian economists and just peruse or go to the von Mises Institute. There are a lot of free papers there you can download on all of these topics, and they're free. It's just a wealth of information that gets into all these subjects. And I highly recommend that you start reading a lot of these, because it's probably the best explanation of what's going on, how it plays out, and how to fix it.
Hello, Jim and John. This is Jeffrey from New York. I had a question in regard to the recent episode about retirement. I was hoping to hear a little bit more about suggestions for future retirees along the lines of peak oil and how they can manage to ease some of the money that they might currently have in portfolios into solar panels, wind energy, geothermal, and better insulation for their house, as well as getting used to the idea that they will need to get a better handle on their food production, maybe by planting a garden and understanding how their agriculture is going to be impacted by the future of peak oil. Thank you.
Jeffrey, got a few of those kind of programs planned for the fall, especially about growing your own food.
Hi, Jim. John, this is John from Bethesda, Maryland, and I was just wondering, speaking of peak oil, I was wondering if you ever heard of the documentary called Houston, We Have a Problem. It's actually my favorite documentary. It has great insight. The Shell CEO admits on that documentary, conventional drilling has peaked. And it also provides great insights into the Cold War and the oil card the U.S. used against the USSR to bankrupt them. So I thought it was a great documentary, and I was wondering if you ever heard of it, and if you have, could you interview the director on your show or possibly? All right, thank you. Keep up the good work.
You know what? I've heard of it. I haven't watched it, but you know what? Thanks for bringing this to my attention. Maybe what I'll do is order the documentary if it's available on DVD, watch it, and if I like it, we'll see what we can do to get the producer of it on the program. Thanks for bringing it to my attention.
Hi, Jim. This is Bob calling from Cincinnati, and I just want to get your opinion on direct registration. I know it's going to be a pain in the tooth for you folks in the securities industry, but there's a lot of buzz going on right now on the internet about the clearing firms and their financial status. Just want to get your input on it. You guys do a fine job, and always look forward to what you have to say about things. Many, many thanks.
Bob, Bob, unfortunately, you're talking about a very complicated topic, and it involves a whole amount of discussion in terms of who can use the service, the benefits, how the service works. What I'd recommend is you go directly to the website, which is dtcc.com, and there's everything you ever wanted to know in terms of its complications, its implications of holding your own securities and book entry form are listed there on the site.
You're listening to the Financial Sense NewsHour at financialsense.com.
Up next on the program is FSN foreign correspondent Eric Townsend. And last week, Eric, we began our discussion. You believe we're in the early stages of a Cold War between China and the United States. Several of the subjects that we covered last week, because this week we're going to continue that theme. Why China may have aspirations of reasserting itself as a global superpower. The role of the sovereign debt contagion from Europe to Japan and back to the United States could provide China with an opportunity. China is currently building a blue water navy. There's been several articles in the Wall Street Journal documenting their capabilities, especially on the submarine side. We also talked about the event off the west coast of California on what appeared to be a missile launch from a Chinese submarine. Picking up from where we left last week, let's talk about, okay, China is establishing a blue water navy, but the U.S. has some capabilities itself. It has an anti-submarine warfare deterrent and anti-ballistic missile deterrent. Although it's interesting, there was a story that came out yesterday on the news that a Russian submarine had been parked in the Gulf of Mexico for 2 weeks, undetected. So this is another incident, but given some of our own capabilities, do you think we have adequate systems and countermeasures in place to rule out, let's say, a successful missile attack on the U.S. mainland by China?
Well, Jim, you know, it was interesting. I got quite a bit of correspondence from last week's interview. Our listener, Doug in Florida, pointed out something that I thought was very insightful, which is there's a big difference between offensive capability and defensive capability. Certainly in terms of projecting force, the United States has just massive ability with, you know, everything from aircraft carriers to nuclear submarines and so on and so forth. But the defensive capability of the country is really a different matter. That has more to do not with how many assets you have, but how well organized and on the ball the government is, which is a different story. Now, if you think about it, most people thought 9/11 was impossible until it happened. Most people thought that the government was ready for something like Hurricane Katrina until it happened, and we saw the fallout of that. The story that just really blows my mind was just 3 weeks ago, July 27th, Oak Ridge, Tennessee. There's a facility called Y-12 where the United States stores all of its highly enriched uranium, which is the active ingredient, if you will, for making nuclear bombs. That security experienced a security breach. A team of three intruders breached the facility, got through four perimeter fences, and into where the actual buildings that store the nuclear bomb material, the highly enriched uranium, are stored. Now, when I first heard this story, I'm thinking like Mission Impossible, you know, except maybe it's Al-Qaeda or something, you know, super sophisticated terrorists doing this horrible thing. Let's look at who this crack team of terrorists were. The terror cell was led by none other than Megan Rice, an 82-year-old Catholic nun. She's not affiliated with Al-Qaeda or Hezbollah. She's actually affiliated with the Society of the Holy Child Jesus. She was assisted by two other crack commandos, Michael Wally, aged 63, and Greg Borta Obed, aged 57. The average age of the commandos in this terror cell was 67. The only tools that they used were bolt cutters and flashlights, which you could buy at any hardware store. And what they did was they got through not one, not two, not three, but four chain link fences, cutting their way in with the bolt cutters. As soon as they got through the first fence, it set off sensors and alarms and so forth. But then they walked for 2 full hours to get to where the buildings are that store the uranium. And the security forces didn't take action until they actually got there. When they arrived, fortunately, they weren't terrorists with a negative or hostile intention. They were anti-nuclear protesters. And so what they did was they basically vandalized the outside of the building where the uranium is stored. They made no attempt to enter it. Fortunately, nothing too bad happened. But you look at something like this, the facility where all of the nuclear bomb-making materials are stored, we think that when we go through all this craziness at the airport with TSA and everything, well, these are necessary measures because the government has to protect us from Al-Qaeda. And then a bunch of senior citizens, three senior citizens, breach the security of the country's most important nuclear bomb-making facility. And so it really says to me that in terms of being ready to defend against surprise attacks and unexpected events, the United States is not in very good shape.
Eric, what did the experts say about this event? I mean, was the enriched uranium really at risk? I mean, if it was this easy for senior citizens to walk in there, I mean, imagine a group of experienced terrorists or well-trained military commandos, if they wanted to do something, they would probably breach the facility and done some real damage.
I think they would have, Jim. Now, the government, of course, claims that the uranium was never at risk, that it was all fine because they didn't get into the building. But Peter Stockton, a former congressional investigator and a security consultant to the Department of Energy, expressed a lot of skepticism about the government's assertions that the nuclear material was never at risk. And he said, and I'll quote, "It is unbelievable that this could happen. The significance is outrageous. If those were terrorists, they could have blown open the door and gotten inside." And this is a guy who is the security consultant to the Department of Energy. I would assume he knows what he's talking about. And it seems to me, as you say, that, you know, real commandos, military types, even if they didn't get inside the building, if you had not three people but 20 terrorists, you know, trucking in a bunch of high explosive, they probably could have blown up the perimeter of the building and created a dirty bomb situation where maybe even if they didn't steal the uranium, they could have compromised the government's ability to use it for its intended purpose. So to me, it's just a crazy story.
You know, storing all of the U.S.'s enriched uranium and its bomb-making capabilities is a very important security issue. I would have thought, Eric, in a facility that's this important strategically, you would have had the best trained Navy SEALs, special force command units that are guarding the facility, but that doesn't seem to be the case here.
Well, that's exactly the crux of the issue, Jim. The security for this facility was not handled by the military. It was contracted out. And not only was it was contracted out to a subsidiary of G4S, the same firm that was implicated in the security scandal at the London Olympics. Now, Jim, I understand that, unfortunately, earmarks are just a part of our political system. And so, you know, if I go to the government offices in East Overshoe and the parking lot is secured by some private contractor that got the contract because they made a campaign donation to some senator, okay, I understand that's the system. But we're talking about where the enriched uranium that you can make nuclear bombs with is stored. This is what they contract out to, you know, rent-a-cops? This is nuts. I can't believe it. Now, of course, the government spokesman said that they're taking this very, very seriously. You know, that's what they said about Madoff and MF Global and PFG Best. And I really got to thinking about this week. And, you know, it occurs to me, Jim, that we shouldn't be surprised by this. Because if you look at what we've seen in financial markets with things like John Corzine had just announced this week that he's going to go launch a new hedge fund. And the government has announced that they've done their initial investigation and decided that there's no reason to pursue any criminal charges. So it looks like he's off the hook for the MF Global debacle. If we've reached the point of corruption where immunity from criminal prosecution can be purchased through campaign contributions, it shouldn't surprise us that this kind of thing is going on. The government has transformed itself into basically a business that is no longer government buy-in for the people, but it's buy-in for the special interests. And it's an inescapable result of that rampant corruption that we're going to experience things like this, where the government has just not got their act together when it comes to something like guarding the most important nuclear security facility in the whole country. And, you know, I just can't help but think, you know, is the nuclear bomb making capability really at risk? I don't know. Could Goldman Sachs profit if it was at risk? Well, that would be the first thing that would tell me that it is at risk. I think we've gotten to the point of corruption in this country where I just don't know what to think anymore, Jim.
It's absolutely amazing when you look at this that the government allows these things to happen. But Eric, let's return to the China and the Cold War story. In the last few weeks, there have been numerous reports of escalating tensions between China, other Asian nations, especially with the Chinese moving military troops onto islands that they claim are their own, why other nations claim they belong to those nations, and even the U.S. over the islands in the South China Sea. So what's going on here? What are you hearing?
Well, there's several different groups of islands in the South China Sea that are being contested, but the theme is basically the same. China is claiming that all of the islands in the South China Sea are its own. And there are several different groups. Some are being contested between China and Japan. Some are between China and Vietnam and Brunei and Malaysia and so on and so forth. China is basically saying, look, South China Sea, it's all ours. In one group, the Senkaku Islands, which is a dispute between China and Japan, Japan is saying, hey, wait a minute, we've been administering these islands for like 250 years. And China's saying, well, yeah, you have, but before that, it was China's, so therefore, we're going back to that. So China is effectively annexing all of the islands in the South China Sea, which other countries claim as their own territory. There was a fishing boat incident between China and Japan where a bunch of sailors were arrested. There's this other issue, which seems to be the most recent hubbub in the news, is the Paracel Islands, which are located between Taiwan and Singapore. China claims them, as do Taiwan, Vietnam, Brunei, Malaysia, and the Philippines. China blasted the United States 2 weeks ago, saying they should, quote, shut up about a dispute which is none of their business. So that's pretty strong language in international diplomatic circles. And basically, the U.S. is concerned about this because they see that China wants these, obviously, for both economic and military reasons. Both China and Japan have threatened military escalation of this matter. And so it's really heating up pretty quickly.
Why are these islands so important, and why is China suddenly being so aggressive about taking control of them? I understand, just from reports that I've read, there's a lot of oil in this area. So is this an oil issue, which is really natural resources, or do they figure this is a strategic issue where they need to have forward-deployed military bases in order to control the South China Seas?
Jim, I think it's both. Certainly, as we talked about last week, China needs to figure out an energy independent strategy where it could operate independent of the West. And it's believed that there's a huge amount of both oil and gas reserves in those waters. So if China has those islands, then it has the territorial waters around them from which it can claim the rights to all of the oil and gas drilling. But I think there's more to it than that, because these islands could be extremely strategic, and we've already seen that China has built a military base on one of the contested islands. In order for China to grow its Blue Water Navy and its military capability, it needs these islands. The other thing is that approximately half of the world's commercial shipping passes through the South China Sea. It's an incredibly busy and important shipping lane for all kinds of commercial traffic. It's also a part of the ocean that U.S. military ships need to pass through in order to be able to achieve their ability to project force globally. So if China had control of the full South China Sea, had military bases with some of these carrier killer missile units that they're developing on those islands, it would create a situation where the U.S. potentially would be locked out of running aircraft carriers through those waters, which would hamper the U.S.'s strike capability against China. It would also hamper their ability to travel around the globe in order to project force elsewhere. So it's a very, very strategic area of water, and it's also a very strategic natural resource base. All of this fits very much into my thesis that we discussed last week. And I think China wants to do is get to the point where it can operate independently from Western resources. So if war came about between the U.S. and China, and China was blockaded against any kind of supply chain from the West, it would have all of the military capability as well as the natural resources in order to operate on its own.
What do you think are some of the other factors that support your thesis that we've begun a Cold War between both the U.S. and China?
Well, three more factors come immediately to mind, Jim. First, China has engaged in a massive investment program in Africa, which is a very resource-rich place. It was actually $100 billion of announced investment commitment to the region. They made that announcement in 2010. Probably there will be considerably more investment over time. Goldman Sachs is involved as a middleman and is helping China to buy all kinds of productive resources. Now, this represents a pretty important change, I think, which is China has been buying commodities from all over the world for years. But now they're starting to buy farms, and they're also sending Chinese citizens to these other countries in order to staff them. Same thing is true in Australia. One of my contacts there told me that so many family-owned farms have already been sold to Chinese investment interests that if this trend were to continue at its present pace, within one generation, about 25 years, China would own the lion's share of the agricultural resources in Australia. So China is really buying up the world. That's number one. Number two, this very important announcement from Hillary Clinton. She wrote an article in the November 2011 Foreign Policy magazine issue. She said that the future of politics will be in Asia, not Iraq or Afghanistan. Now, she's using the word politics. I think that that's a euphemism. I think she means the future of military conflict will be in Asia, not Iraq or Afghanistan. And there was an announcement that the U.S. military forces will strategically be redeployed more so in Asia as opposed to the Middle East. There's also been a lot of rhetoric directed at China since that announcement. These are all Cold War tactics, Jim. These are the ways that through diplomacy and rhetoric and statements and so forth, nations basically threaten one another. And I think that's exactly what you see going on with Hillary Clinton's big announcement about military deployments. Is she saying, China, we're getting ready to play tough with you guys. Number three, China has a virtual monopoly at this point on rare earth element productions, and long-time Financial Sense listeners are well familiar with this issue. A lot of military equipment depends on rare earth elements, also things like windmills, electric motors, and so forth, high-efficiency motors, hybrid cars, all depend on these rare earth elements. Almost all of the production capacity is in China. China has already started to ban exports of raw rare earth elements in favor of a policy where they'll only ship finished products that include those rare earth elements. So they're effectively saying, if you want stuff that uses these things, you've got to buy those finished products from us. And of course, you've covered that with several interviews that you've done on Financial Sense in the last year or two.
Well, it's interesting that you mention Hillary Clinton, because I read the article in Foreign Policy, and of course, I live here in San Diego, which is home to four aircraft carrier battle groups and a submarine base. And we've seen the buildup of Navy assets in San Diego, which is the forward deployment for whether you're talking about the Middle East or Asia. And we've seen that develop here, Eric, over the last decade, where there's a high concentration of forward deployment power based here in San Diego. I mean, if you take 12 aircraft carrier battle groups, four of them in San Diego, plus a sub base, plus we have Camp Pendleton for the Marines, and then we also have the largest Navy SEAL training special combat forces also based here in San Diego. So San Diego is a key strategic area, and it always makes you nervous when you hear that there was a Russian sub that was in the Gulf of Mexico for 2 weeks undetected, or the Chinese sub that supposedly had done a missile launch off Los Angeles. Now, a lot of people listening to this conversation, Eric, would think that maybe you and I are a little bit out there in terms of a Cold War between the U.S. and China. I mean, after all, China's whole economy depends on exporting goods to the U.S. They're also our largest creditor. So how would you argue against that?
Well, you know, certainly most people would think that what I said last week is nuts, that China could put a submarine in striking range of the United States and blow us up with ballistic missiles. That's crazy talk. Well, what'd you just say, Jim? That it turned out to be a Russian, not a Chinese submarine. But a submarine sitting in the Gulf of Mexico, totally undetected by U.S. defense forces for 2 weeks, is a reality that we know is true. Now, on the issue about the Chinese economy, I agree and I disagree. It certainly is true that right now, this moment in August of 2012, China can't afford to lose the U.S. as a customer for its exported goods. But a lot of people don't realize that exports to the United States only represent about 9% of Chinese GDP. That's 1 year's growth in their economy. They can't afford to lose that right now, but they're moving in a direction towards independence. And I think that China's goal is to get to the point where they can afford to lose all exports to the United States and still be able to keep their economy functioning. They're not there yet, but I think in 10 years it's going to be a very different story.
How do you think these moves on China compare with, let's say, past events in Chinese history? I mean, you know, most of us think of the modern Western world. China was the world's largest economy up until the Industrial Revolution in the 18th century, and it's always been a major power for thousands of years. So put this in the context of China's history.
It's a really, really profound point, Jim, and I think that we're entering a new paradigm here, because historically, China, although it was the global dominant economic power for thousands of years, historically, China never really had any aspirations outside of its own borders. Unlike other big empires like Rome or Britain, China historically was never very imperialistic. They didn't go try to colonize or take over the rest of the world. But what we're now seeing, with certainly the example in the South China Sea, is signs of Chinese imperialism. So they're starting to go, whether it's the South China Sea or the projects they're doing in Africa or buying up agricultural resources in Australia, China has realized, I think, that in order to play in the globalized economy, they have to be imperialistic to some extent, and they have to assert global mercantilist ambitions in order to be able to operate, because a lot of the natural resources that they need come from other places around the globe. Now, that means that we're in a whole different mindset than China has had before, where they didn't previously try to project power around the world. And now, as evidenced by the build out of their Blue Water Navy, they're trying to do that. That means that we're in uncharted territory. I don't know how to analyze what might happen next. You know, you look at these nuclear submarines that have the ability to launch a dozen nuclear warhead missiles that have thousands and thousands of miles of range. Are they doing that because it's a defensive move and they just want to get a mutual assured destruction doctrine in place so that the U.S. would not dare to attack them? Or are they trying to create a first strike capability where they might actually make a preemptive attack against the United States? There's no way of knowing that because there's no historical precedent to draw an opinion from, because this whole idea of imperialism is new territory for China.
Let's break this down in terms of our listeners. What does this mean for investors? If there's a specific investment strategy that would benefit if things play out, if this indeed is a new Cold War between the United States and China. We know that, for example, in the Cold War between the United States and Russia, the investing in the defense industries was a growth strategy. So what does this imply?
Well, we're in early stages of this, and there's so many variables that I think it's very hard to lay out a step-by-step invest in this and you'll make money kind of answer to that. I think that investors need to be astute and be aware of developing events between the United States and China, and pay particularly close attention to the posturing that the U.S. military does, how much more they continue to assign troops and ships and bases and so forth in Asia rather than the Middle East. But there are some clear themes here. I would say, first to listeners, if you haven't yet read The Fourth Turning by Strauss and Howe, now's the time, because that book is all about the process that we're going through of coming into a period in history where conflict, potentially military conflict around the globe, is going to be very important to understand. wars, whether they're cold wars or otherwise, are generally inflationary. And the reason is that if a country prints money and uses that money to build roads and bridges and infrastructure and so forth, well, those roads and bridges support the economy and they support that country's ability to be economically competitive. But if you're spending a lot of printed money on bombs and missiles and so forth, those things get blown up as soon as they're used. So they don't really support the economy on an ongoing basis. So I think that inflation in general is going to be a theme. I expect a major return of inflation, and I think that assets like gold, crude oil, are probably going to do very well in coming years. Another theme is that China is buying up productive assets all around the world. So there are all kinds of investment plays you could think of depending on where you're located and what your knowledge and capabilities are. The Australian farmland example that I gave earlier is a perfect example of this. If you're in Australia and you know all about farming, you might look at where you could front run China in terms of buying up farmland assets. But of course, there's another side to that, which is that the Australian government may recognize this, as I think they should, as something of an economic threat to the long-term viability of the country. And maybe they'll shut that down and not allow China to buy more of their productive assets. So for people who have the inside track on information on how things like that are developing, you can certainly imagine some investment strategies. Japan and Australia are probably going to have to monetize in order to cope with the currency appreciation and the need to refinance their debt. Gold's going to do well. Oil's going to do well. Commodities in general should do well. And of course, defense stocks should outperform. China dumping U.S. treasuries is going to be a really important theme that I think is coming someday. I don't know if that's tomorrow or 10 years from now, Jim, but the day that China strategically gets rid of its massive U.S. treasury holdings is going to have a profound impact on U.S. markets. And when that starts to happen, understanding how and why it's happening is going to be key.
Yeah, and that's a big risk. I interviewed former Comptroller General David Walker, and he's got a new paper out, Eric, that talks about 50% of our debt is now held by foreigners, and a good portion of that is in Chinese hands. So as we summarize what you're saying about this, the Chinese view is that China should be a preeminent world power. All signs suggest they're preparing to regain that status. The submarine threat to the U.S. is very serious, and we talked last week about China, and we just found out this week there was a Russian sub in the Gulf of Mexico. U.S. carriers clearly are vulnerable more than previously thought, and that's been a view held in military circles with the concept of the arsenal ship versus the carrier. Events like subs surfacing during war games are Cold War tactics. I mean, when a Chinese sub surfaces in the middle of a carrier battle group during a war exercise, that's a pretty strong statement. We're seeing more tensions, and especially now during a presidential election year, they're heating up. The U.S., we know, is very, very dependent on China's treasury investments to support our debt and growing debt imbalances. The next two decades are likely to be a new Sino-American Cold War, which has already begun. Investors should consider what these long-term trends will mean for the markets. And finally, is there anything else you'd like to add to these summaries before we close?
Just a couple other thoughts, Jim. One, I don't think this is all about China as the bad guy. You know, the U.S. is as guilty as China is in terms of spinning the news to suit their own agenda. All this stuff about currency manipulation is a perfect example. You know, they lambaste China as currency manipulator, when all China has done is peg its currency to the U.S. dollar. And the way they implement that peg is by buying the U.S. Treasury bonds that we desperately need them to buy in order to finance the reckless spending that Congress keeps approving. So I don't think China's the bad guy. I think it's basically a tension that's growing between two superpowers. But, you know, what history teaches us is that in a Cold War, it's not about virtue or who's right or wrong. It's about which country runs itself into the ground economically. Now, if you look at the situation here, U.S. versus China, the U.S. used to be the biggest creditor nation in the world and has now become the biggest debtor nation in the history of the world. Who's it up against in this Cold War? Its primary creditor, which is China. This is not a good situation for the United States, and I really think that our politicians in Washington need to get a grip and recognize that we can't just go on spending beyond our means and borrowing money from a country that could be our adversary in what looks like, to me, an evolving Cold War.
You know, it's amazing that you said that, because we used to be the largest producer of rare earth elements with Molycorp's mine here in California. That was shut down by the environmentalists. And by the way, the people contributing to the environmental campaign, we find out part of that money came from China. And a couple of years ago, Eric, the U.S. military woke up and said, wait a minute, all these missiles, all this sophisticated military technology that we have requires rare earth elements and materials, and China has a monopoly of 97%. So they've allowed the reactivation of Molycorp's mine, because you imagine how, if we ever had to go into conflict or a conflict break out, you can imagine the U.S. military saying, can we call a halt to hostilities? We need you guys to ship over some rare earth elements so we can make some more bombs to fire back at you. That's not going to work. Well, listen, as we close, if our listeners like to contact you, Eric, tell them how they could do so, if you would.
Just email me at eric.townsend@financialsense.com.
All right, we've been speaking with FSN foreign correspondent Eric Townsend. Eric will be back after we come back from our August recess. Eric, thanks for joining us on the program.
Always my pleasure. And Jim, you have a fantastic and well-deserved vacation. We'll see you after the Labor Day.
Looking forward to the next 2 weeks here on the program for a number of reasons. Number one,
we get to take time off.
And second of all, this is the time of year when we have traditionally, it seems to become an annual function, we do programs which we're this year calling Behind the Curtain, trying to look at those hidden agendas that might be driving the political and economic headlines we hear about all year long. So we have quite a panoply of guests here.
Yeah, over the next 2 weeks, some of our guests will be Lou Rockwell, Bill Murphy from GATA, on manipulation of silver prices. Carl Tykrib from Forcing Change will be on the show, as well as Andrew Gavin Marshall on the Bilderbergers. That always gets a lot of attention. And then we're going to do two roundtables, one on global warming. We'll have Dr. Tim Ball, Mark Morano, and meteorologist Joe Bastardi. We'll debate that issue. And then also on Agenda 21, Tom DeWeese, Dr. Michael Kaufman, and Karen Schoen, how property rights are essential for capitalism and what the environmental movement is doing to remove some of those rights. We'll talk about issues such as smart growth. Where are we going with this? That and much, much more coming up in the next 2 weeks ahead. And, of course, we'll be back after Labor Day with our regular show format. So a lot of great stuff coming up. And, of course, our premium service, just some, God, what a marathon week, wasn't it, John? What do we do, over 20 interviews this week?
Yeah, to try to put enough interviews in the can to allow us to take time off. And we should point out, Jim, by the way, that if something important breaks, we will come back, as we have done in times past over the last decade, and do a special Financial Sense News Hour, because the ones for the next 2 weeks are being pre-recorded and put in the can ahead of time so we can take time off. But if something really happens, we'll make sure that you hear about it and we give you our input.
And, you know, well, there's an old saying, anytime, John, you and I take off in August, what happens? We had, remember 2005, Katrina and Rita, the credit crisis in 2008, the bankruptcy of Lehman, things falling apart. And somebody said August is probably the most dangerous month of the year. Let me just give you a little bit of history why we say that. August 4th, 1914, the outbreak of World War I. August 2nd, 1934, German President Paul von Hindenburg dies, giving rise to Hitler in Germany. August 1938, Germany mobilizes for war. August 23rd, 1939, the Nazi-Soviet pact was signed. August 31st, 1939, Hitler orders the invasion of Poland. August 6th and 9th, 1945, the U.S. drops two atomic bombs on Japan. August 1947, British rule ended in India. August 1948, the USSR broke off diplomatic relations with the U.S., the beginning of the Cold War. August 13th, 1961, construction of the Berlin Wall begins. August 5th, Nelson Mandela was arrested. August 2nd, 1964, the Vietnam War begins with the Gulf of Tonkin incident. August 1966, China's Cultural Revolution begins. August 20th, 1968, Russia invades Czechoslovakia. August 15th, 1971, President Nixon ends gold backing of the U.S. dollar, the Bretton Woods system. August 23rd, 1973, Yom Kippur War, the beginning of it, with a meeting between Saudi King Faisal and Egyptian President Anwar Sadat in Riyadh. August 8th, 1974, President Nixon resigns. August 19th, 1978, the Cinema Rex fire occurred in Abadan, Iran. August 25th, the stock market peaked in 1987. August 2nd, 1990, Saddam Hussein invades Kuwait. August 1991, Soviet Premier Gorbachev goes on holiday and his rule ends. August 17th, 1998, the Russian government devalues the ruble, defaults on its domestic debt, and declares a moratorium on payment to foreign creditors. August 9th, 2007, BNP Paribas suspends three funds, ushering in the 2008 financial crisis. I could go on, John, but
I make a motion. We all vote to cancel August. There we go. That solves that problem.
Yeah, we'd get rid of that problem by canceling August. Isn't that amazing? You take a look at historically all those events. Just fascinating. So anyway, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The weather here has been as nice as it can be. Although it doesn't really matter much to me.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk. We'll be right back.